Hello and welcome to a new edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior. This is the international service of the Argentine Radio, transmitting from the city of Buenos Aires via the shortwaves of WRMI, Miami Radio International, and also via internet on rae.com.ar. This is Fernando Farias speaking, and together with sound technician Sergio Rios, we'll be bringing you this show in English for Tuesday, July 15. 2025. We'll have news, we'll have sports, and today we'll have a pretty interesting piece from the late 1970s, 1977 to be more exact, which is an interview that the late writer Jorge Luis Borges gave to the American TV outlet PBS for their show Firing Line, hosted by the legendary William Buckley. Well, Mr. Buckley came with his crew in 1977 to Argentina at the beginning of the military dictatorship, and they talked to Borges about several things, current affairs, back then obviously, current affairs of the early 1970s, literature, history, Latin America, a little bit of everything, and Borges, who was fluent in English, in fact, they spoke English in his house when he was a child. He was had partly English background in his heritage. Well, he speaks to Mr. Buckley about several topics, and this is a historic archive file that we are sharing with you today on this program of RAE for Tuesday, July 15, 2025. Our show airs via the shortwaves of WRMI on the frequency of 5,850 kHz and also via internet on rae.com.ar. You also have the possibility of downloading our app for mobile devices that you can download for free, Digital RAE, available for both Apple and Android phones. And let me remind you that if you want to get in touch with us, you can send emails to qslrae@gmail.com or letters to Maipú Street, 555, and then of course Buenos Aires, Argentina. Either way is okay for sending reception reports if you are at the EXA. Let's get started now with the news. These are the headlines. Inflation in Argentina showed a slight increase in June, reaching 1.6%. A U.S. judge rejected the Argentine government's request and upheld a ruling requiring the transfer of YPF shares. Brazil's President Lula da Silva signed a decree to impose reciprocal tariffs on the U.S. Uruguay's government agreed to modify its new passports after they were rejected by European countries. Another dead whale was found off the coast of Buenos Aires City. Sports: Argentina's top flight football league completed the first round of the Clausura tournament. And these are the news. Argentina's inflation rose slightly in June, reaching 1.6%, according to the official statistics agency INDEC. In May, inflation, let's recall, had been 1.5%, and with these figures, the year-to-date total now stands at 15%. INDEC reported that the biggest monthly price increase came in the education sector, followed by housing. Despite the small rise, President Javier Milei celebrated the figures on social media, stating that good Argentines are celebrating this. A U.S. judge rejected the Argentine government's request to suspend the YPF ruling. Judge Loretta Presca of New York reaffirmed her order requiring Argentina to hand over 51% of the state oil company YPF to British investment fund Burford. She dismissed Argentina's appeal to delay the decision, which involves a $16 billion compensation to the plaintiffs. According to Presca, Argentina made no effort to meet the conditions since the trial began in 2012. Burford holds the legal rights to sue Argentina over the 2012 nationalization of YPF, which took place under former President Cristina Fernández de Kirchner. Brazilian President Lula da Silva signed the decree allowing reciprocal tariffs against the US. This move follows Donald Trump's announcement last week of a 50% tariff on Brazilian imports. The American president cited both a trade deficit and Brazil's legal case against former President Jair Bolsonaro as reasons for the measure. Mr. Trump, a close ally of Bolsonaro, called the legal case a witch hunt. But Lula responded that this was an unacceptable interference in Brazil's internal affairs. Another dead whale was found along the coast of Buenos Aires, this time near the Memorial Park by the Jorge Newbery domestic airport. Initial reports suggest a 6-meter-long whale became stranded in the shallow waters of the Rio de la Plata. Authorities say the animal was a sei whale, which is a species considered endangered. Less than a week ago, let's recall, a similar individual was found dead further north in Vicente López shores. Uruguay has decided to revise its new passports after they were rejected by France and Germany. Montevideo will once again include the place of birth on these documents. Let's recall that since April, this data had been omitted from passports, leading to travel restrictions for Uruguayans in European nations. President Yamandú Orsi of Uruguay confirmed that the documents will be corrected in order to comply with international standards. And now, sports. The opening round of Argentina's Clausura football tournament has been completed. The latest results are Deportivo Riestra 1, Lanús 0 for Group B, Banfield 0, Defensa y Justicia 0 for Group A, Vélez and Tigre were playing each other for the interzone category, and Vélez prevailed 2-1. En Unión defeated Estudiantes for Group A 1-0. And these were the news on RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo. RAE, Argentina, 面向世界.
RAE, Argentina vers le monde.
RAE, Argentina to the world.
RAE, 世界に向けて, Argentin.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo.
La RAE, Argentina al Mondo.
RAE, Argentinian in the Welt.
RAE, Argentina al Mundo.
Now we're going to play a piece that was recorded in the year 1977 here in Argentina. On that occasion, a crew of American TV outlet, TV network, PBS, came down to Argentina and they brought their show Firing Line, hosted by the late William Buckley, who interviewed the late Jorge Luis Borges, arguably the most important writer of all times from Argentina, a serious candidate to win the Nobel Literature Prize, even though he never won it, but certainly a must-read for anyone who loves literature, not only within the Spanish-speaking world, but globally. Borges's works are studied at literature majors all over the world, and he is a major reference when it comes to Spanish language literature. He was born in Buenos Aires, was raised for a time in Europe, in Geneva more precisely, but then he spent most of his life in the country until the final months before dying, when he moved back to Geneva. He passed away in the year 1986. Borges was, well, simply brilliant, not just as a writer, but as an observer of Argentine history, culture, music. He was a fan and an expert in tango music and tango literature, tango philosophy and lyrics. And, well, he talks about several subjects with Buckley on Firing Line in this interview in English, which he spoke fluently, as well as other languages. As I mentioned before, Borges was of English background partly, and it is said that in his home, when he was a child, English was spoken as the main language at home. So well, that's why he spoke English so well. He even was a student, a scholar of all English. He even wrote stuff in all English, like ancient English, English from the 15th century or so. So well, this is it. Borges on PBS, year 1977.
About himself, he said recently, "As for a message, well, I have no message.
Right. No message whatever.
Some things simply occur to me, and I write them down with no aim to hurt anyone or to convert anyone. This is all I can say. I make this public confession of my poverty before everybody. Besides, had I not done so, you would have known it was true." Yes, that's what I said.
Yes.
I'm just going to finish this introduction and then we'll exchange.
Right, yes.
About him, others have written that he is the greatest living writer. Still others that he has influenced the literature of the world more than anyone alive. Jorge Luis Borges lives here in Buenos Aires, although he has traveled extensively, especially in the United States, and taught most recently at Harvard for a year. He is blind since the late 50s. He does not mind it, he says, because now he can live his dreams with less distraction. He took early to his craft, translating into Spanish from the English Oscar Wilde's The Happy Prince when he was 6 years old. The translation, thought to have been the work of his father, was used as a school text. He began to publish in the 20s poems, essays, short works of fiction. In the late 30s, he got his first job as a menial assistant in a library, but even this he lost for the offense of having signed a declaration in opposition to General Perón in 1946. When Perón was ousted, Mr. Borges was made director of the National Library, and his literary work continuing at an extraordinary rate, and including now translations into Spanish of major American writers. He took to lecturing widely, acquainting many Americans with his writings and with himself. Concerning his work, his critics disagree, except on the proposition that it will survive the century. Mr. Borges is substantially but not entirely apolitical. Since Argentina is having its problems, I thought to begin by asking, is there anything, Mr. Borges, distinctively Argentinian about those problems?
Well, I wonder. I know very little about politics, but I think we have the right government now, government of gentlemen, not of hoodlums. I don't think we're ripe for the democracy as yet, maybe in 100 years or so. But now I think we have the right government. I think that the government means well, and the government is acting, and, as I said, we are going by gentlemen and not by the scum of the earth, as happened, well, quite a short time ago.
When you say that it might be 100 years before...
Well, or let's say 500, no.
After our time.
Yes.
Why is that? Is it something distinctive to Are Argentinians distinctive to the hemisphere, distinctive to what?
I can't tell you, since I know my own country and I'm very puzzled by my country. I wish I understood my country. I can only love it. I can do what I can for it, but I don't pretend to understand it. I'm no historian.
Well, when you say that you don't understand it, do you mean that you are continually surprised by what happens?
Yes, I am continually surprised, but I try to live in my own private, secluded, in my own private the literary world.
Well, do you recognize an obligation of the man of letters to involve himself in politics to the extent of saying no to the barbarians?
Yes, to that extent I do, not more than that. I think that if I do my literary work honestly, then in a sense I am doing something for my country. And if I can do nothing else, being old, blind, and lonely, I try to do my work as well as I can. That's all I can do. I have never involved myself in politics. I have never allowed myself to be bribed. I haven't even tried to be famous, though I have become quite famous. But I have done nothing whatever to it in that sense. I have merely kept on writing, never thinking of the public or of the readers. I write to please myself. I mean, if I were Robinson Crusoe in my desert island, I would go on writing. And I suppose I would write more or less the same kind of stuff I'm turning out now.
Well, you were criticized, to be sure, in a left journal in America for instance, advocating the execution of Regis Debray in Bolivia. Is that correct?
Yes, I suppose it's correct. But after all, I think that capital punishment is kinder than it's a prison. I'm not against capital punishment. I wouldn't mind being executed, but I wouldn't like spending 5 years in jail. Personally, I wouldn't mind being executed. In fact, I think I would welcome it, since I'm rather tired of life, since life has few pleasures left to me.
Well, if you insist on being executed, let me know and I'll suggest a provocation.
You think of the jail more.
No.
Well, why not? Maybe you're right. Well, he wasn't being sentimental about himself or feeling sorry for himself. Or abounding, as Kipling had it, in loud self-pity. I don't think a man should abound in loud self-pity. At least I have tried my best to not to do so.
Well, do you find this challenge, this inclination to self-pity a characteristic of the age?
I wonder if a characteristic of the age. I know very little about the age. But maybe it is rather common here in this country. People go in for being sorry for themselves, which is a pity, I think. But of course, if you go in for being sorry for yourself, then you keep on being sadder and sadder, no?
You mean because there's so much to be sorry for?
Oh, yes. But sometimes, walking down the street, I sometimes feel unaccountably happy, and then I welcome that happiness. Because I don't know where that happiness comes from, but still it should be welcomed. I think happiness should always be welcomed.
Is it a happiness that comes as a result of the satisfaction you take in your work?
No, personally, I dislike my work. I prefer the work of any other writer. I think that every time I have not been given the Nobel Prize, I think that the Swedish Academy has acted justly. I don't deserve that prize. When I think that...
Well, you certainly don't deserve to be put in the same class with Quasimodo.
But I don't deserve to be put in the same class as Kipling or Faulkner or Bernard Shaw.
Well, they can't miss all the time.
No.
Well, do you mean you have officially abandoned any intention of receiving the Nobel Prize?
No. I think it's a kind of game that is played every year. You know, every year I am given the Nobel Prize, and then it turns out it's next year. It's a kind of habit I have, or a kind of habit that the Scandinavians have. In fact, you might recall an old Norse tradition, no, not to give me the Nobel Prize. No. That's a part of Norse mythology, and very fond of Norse.
I love all things Scandinavian. Is it your point that you would lose respect in the Nobel Committee if they awarded you the prize?
I would think it was a very generous mistake, but I would accept it greedily.
What are you at work on now, Mr. Borges?
Well, precisely, I'm working on a book with a friend of mine, Maria Kodama, on Snorri Sturlason, the Icelandic historian. And then I'm also writing a book of poems to be published by EMSA in Buenos Aires. And then a book of short stories to be published by EMSA in Buenos Aires. And I'm writing off and on all the time, since I have nothing else to do. I live by myself.
Well, now you say that you dislike your work. Do you also dislike working?
No, I enjoy working, but I don't like the work. You know what Carlyle said? Carlyle said that all work is contemptible, but that doing that work is not contemptible. It may be the only justification for a man. And I think he was right, because after all, when I'm working and fulfilling my destiny, what else can I do but work? What else can a blind man do but work? But as a result of the work, I leave that to others. I never reread what I have written, except when I have to go to proof sheets. But I enjoy working. And not only working, but I enjoy planning my work. Perhaps more than the actual writing of it or dictating of it, since writing, of course, has been forbidden to me, no?
You have been compared to both Milton and Homer.
Well, yes, in the sense of being blind, yes.
Yes. But in other senses, too, you've been compared to them. I know that you make it a practice not to read anything about yourself.
No, I only read one book, a book published by a Bolivian, mm-hmm. named Tamayo, and an Argentine writer, Ruiz Diaz. That's the only book I read about. And they tell me there are some 300 books written about me. But I think the writer should choose a better subject.
Well, in that case, I'm in a position to instruct you about yourself.
Ah, well, I suppose you are.
You've been compared to both Milton and Homer in terms of a highly illuminated internal vision. Is this a correct judgment as far as you're concerned?
Well, I do my best to think it a correct judgment. At least, I try to put up with blindness. Of course, when you're blind, time flows in a different way. It flows, let's say, down an easy slope. I have sometimes spent sleepless nights, night before last, for example, but I didn't feel especially unhappy about it, because time was, well, sliding down that, was flowing down that easy slope.
You mean you'd have felt less, more unhappy if you had been able to see?
Oh, yes, of course I would.
Why?
Well, I can't very well explain that. These are a sort of years. When I first went blind, I mean for reading purposes, I felt very unhappy. But now I feel that being blind is, let's say, is part of my world. I suppose that happens to everybody. When one's in jail, one thinks of being in jail as being a part of one's world, or one's sick also, after all.
Well, how do you refresh yourself as someone who is blind?
Well, I'm rereading all the time, having books reread to me.
See.
I do very little contemporary reading, but I'm always going back to certain writers. And among those writers, I would like to mention an American writer. I would like to mention Emerson. I think of Emerson, it's not only as a great prose writer, everybody knows that, but a very fine intellectual poet. But that's the only intellectual poet who had any ideas, no? Emerson was brimming over with ideas.
Well, you did a great deal to reintroduce Americans to many American writers, including Emerson, isn't that correct?
Yes, I have done my best.
Now, what is it that
Emerson and also, well, another writer I greatly love.
Hawthorne.
Well, but in Hawthorne, what I dislike about Hawthorne is all writing fables. But in the case of Poe, well, you get tales, there was no moral tagged on to them, no. Well, in the case of Hawthorne, things are always becoming lessons or parables. But I would think of Melville. one of the great writers of the world, no?
How do you account for the failure of Melville to achieve any recognition during his lifetime? Any significant recognition?
Because people thought of him as writing travel books. I have the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. There's an article about Melville, and they speak of him much in the same way as they might speak about Captain Marryat, for example, or other writers. I think that he wrote many of the travel books. People thought of him as writing in that way, so they couldn't see all that the Moby Dick or the White Whale meant.
What part did you play in the rediscovery of Melville?
Well, in this country, I've done what I could, I suppose.
Had it already been translated when you were a student?
No, when I was a student, no, it hadn't been translated. It had been translated afterwards. And I translated a very fine story of Melville's. You know it, of course, it's Bartleby.
Yes. You translated that for the first time?
Yes, for the first time. Then I also, I think, we did the first translation of Hawthorne's The Wakefield. Mm-hmm. A very fine story. After the manner of Kafka, or rather Kafka came after him, no? But Kafka enabled us to read Hawthorne better, which is what a great writer does. In a sense, he creates the forerunners. He makes people read them in a different way. So maybe I shouldn't have read Hawthorne's Wakefield as well as I did, or as I should have done, had I not read Kafka before. I think that's one of the functions, one of the gifts of a great writer, is to make people read in a different way, go over the old text in a different fashion. So the past has been continued, or modified, no?
Yes, yes. Well, now you say that you spend most of your time reading the older writers now. Is it because you reject the newer writers, or because you choose to continue to be unfamiliar with them?
Because I'm afraid that I'll find the new writers more or less like myself. I'm afraid.
You won't.
Well, I suppose I will. I suppose all contemporaries are more or less alike, no? The side is like what I write. I prefer going back to the 19th, to the 18th century, and then, of course, also going back to the Romans, since I have no Greek, but I had Latin. Of course, my Latin is very rusty, but still, as I once wrote, the fact of having forgotten Latin is in itself a gift.
Yes.
To have known Latin and forgotten it is something that sticks to you somehow.
And has to
you. But I have done most of my reading in English. I read very little in Spanish. Because I was educated practically in my father's library, and that was compounded of English books. So when I think of the Bible, I think of the King James Bible. When I think of the Arabian Nights, I think of Lane's translation or of Captain Burton's translation. When I think, of course, of Persian literature, I think in terms of Brown's Literary History of Persia and, of course, of Fitzgerald's. And in fact, I remember the first book I read on History of South America was Prescott's Conquest of Peru.
Is that right?
Yes, and then I fell back on Spanish writers. Yes. But I have done most of my reading in English. I find English far finer language than Spanish.
Why?
Well, there are many reasons. Firstly, English is both a Germanic and a Latin language. It goes two registers. For example, for any idea you take, you have two words. Those words do not mean exactly the same. For example, if I say regal, they're not exactly the same thing as saying kingly. But if I say fraternal, they're not the same as saying brotherly. Or dark and obscure. Those words are different. It will make all the difference, speaking, for example, of the Holy Spirit. It will make all the difference in the world in a poem if I wrote about the Holy Spirit, not about the Holy Ghost. Since ghost is a fine, dark Saxon word, while spirit is a light, a Latin word. Well, and then there is another reason. The reason is that I think that of all languages, English is the most physical of all languages.
The most what?
Physical. Mm-hmm. For example, he loomed over. You can't very well say that in Spanish.
Asomó?
Well, no, but it's not exactly the same. And then in English, you can do... Well, you can do almost anything with verbs and prepositions. For example, to laugh off, to dream away. Those things can't be said in Spanish. To live down something, to live up to something. You can't say those things in Spanish. It can't be said, or in the Romance language. I suppose it can be said in German, but my German isn't too good. I taught myself German for the sake of reading Schopenhauer in the text. That was way back in 1916. I had read Schopenhauer in English. I was greatly attracted to Schopenhauer, and then I thought, I'll try and read him in the text. And then I taught myself German, and then at long last I read Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung in the text, and the Parergun Paralipomen also.
Well, do you write your poetry in English or in Spanish?
No, I respect English too much. I write it in Spanish.
Well, do you pass on the translations? Do you personally pass on the translations, or do you simply entrust them to people like Carrigan?
No, I have people like Alistair Reid, Di Giovanni and Carrier, who greatly bettered my texts, greatly better than them in a translation. And then, of course, in Spanish, words are far too cumbersome, they're far too long. Well, I go back to one of my hobbies. For example, if you take an English adverb, or two English adverbs, you say, for example, quickly, slowly, and then the stress falls on the significant part of the word, quickly, slowly. Well, if you say it in Spanish, you say lentamente, rapidamente, and then the stress falls, let's say, on the non-significant part, on the gadget,
right,
I call it,
right,
no?
Right.
And all that makes it a very cumbersome language.
Yes.
But still, Spanish is my destiny, it's my fate, and I have to do what I can with Spanish.
Well, does the fact that the Spanish language is less resourceful than the English language necessarily make it less complete as poetry?
No, I think that when poetry is achieved, it can be achieved in any language. And I suppose that a fine Spanish verse could hardly be translated into another language. Or return to something else. But when beauty happens, well, there it is, no?
Yes.
You know what Whistler said? People were discussing art in Paris. People spoke about, the influence of heredity, tradition, environment, and so on. And then Whistler said in his lazy way, art happens.
Art happens. Yes.
Art happens, and that's true. And I should say that beauty happens. And besides, I think that beauty is not something rare. I think beauty is happening all the time. Art is happening all the time. In a chance conversation, a man may say a very fine thing, not being aware of it. I'm hearing fine sentences all the time, from the man in the street, for example, from anybody.
So you consider yourself a transcriber to a certain extent?
Yes, in a sense I do. And I think that I have written some fine lines, because everybody has written some fine lines. Mm-hmm. That's not my privilege. You writers are bound to write something fine, at least now and then, or off and on.
Even Longfellow?
Longfellow has some very beautiful lines. I'm very old-fashioned, but I like, this is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlock. That's a very fine line.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't know how people look down on Longfellow. Maybe he was too much of a literary man, no? He was much the same kind of poet as Ezra Pound, no? I mean, he took most things from his books and not from his own experience. But his translation of the Divine Comedy is a very fine translation. In fact, I read it in English or read it in Italian.
You did? Whose translation?
Longfellow's translation.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And I began, because I've always been a bit of a prig, by reading firstly the notes and then the text. Mm-hmm. The first thing I read were the notes as a boy. And then I went on to the text. And then I took up the text. That must have been, some 30 years ago. And then I found out that I had no necessity of knowing Italian. That if I had Spanish, I had Italian, and that Italian could be, and that the Divine Comedy could be read by anybody who had Spanish. So that's all the languages are much the same. The Italian editions of the Commedia are very fine. From Momigliano, for example, or Greba, or the Grabher. There's a note to almost every line. So if you don't understand the verse itself, fall back on the notes. That's very interesting. I think I have read the Divine Comedy some 11 or 12 times over, and I have no Italian. I couldn't talk to an Italian or to see an Italian film or hear an Italian film. I couldn't understand it. And I have no Italian blood. But somehow Italian and Spanish Well, they're so alike.
Well, would you understand it if it were read to you?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But if it were read to me, it might be read too quickly.
Yes, yes.
Well, if I don't understand a line in Italian, then of course I can reread it.
Yes. These thoughts that go through your mind that you transcribe, as you put it, into prose and poetry.
Yeah, I wonder if there's an essential difference. I don't think so. I think the gist is the same, no? I mean, when an idea comes to me, I don't know whether it will become a tale, it will become a short story, or a sonnet, or maybe an example of free verse. That comes afterwards. Firstly, I see the whole thing from afar. And then somehow it has to be licked into shape.
Now, this was as much true when you could see as
yes.
Since?
Always, yes.
The technique was always the same?
The technique is always the same. The technique is the technique of being, let's say, an onlooker, of seeing things, but seeing them at first in a very misty way. And then afterwards, while getting nearer them, seeing them closer. But in the case of a story, or even in the case of a poem, I always know the beginning and the end. Generally, I know the first line and the last line, or at least what will happen. But then I have to find out what happens in between, no? And then, of course, I have to grope and maybe and lose my way and maybe go back.
Oh, you do have to struggle in between, do you?
Of course I do. But the struggle is part of the game.
That's not merely an act of transcription.
No, it isn't. But the struggle makes for enjoyment.
But do you know at the outset that you're going to succeed if you know the first and last lines?
Yes, I know. But I wonder if I have succeeded. People say I have now and then.
I think there's a lot of agreement on that point.
Well, but if I don't believe in democracy, why should I believe in a lot of agreement? No. It's all those mere statistics.
But is there a critical democracy in which you do believe, or do you find that the opinion of the critics is often mistaken? So that very little expertise lies in the field.
Having been a critic, I know that their opinions are generally mistaken. In fact, I have been mistaken many times over.
Can you give an example of someone whose reputation was for years mistaken? Is Melville a good example?
Melville might be. Mm-hmm. But Melville now, I think, holds his own, no?
Yes.
And he should.
Yes.
They're not in all his books.
Is there a living writer who is vastly underappreciated?
I know very little about living writers. In my case, I could say that I'm overrated. Greatly overrated. My stuff is greatly overrated.
Well, what about Neruda?
Neruda, when he was a sentimental poet, he was quite bad. When he was a communist, he wrote very fine poetry. That means that communism was the kind of food he needed, no? Even as Walt Whitman needed the democracy, no? But I think Neruda is a fine poet. In fact, I was in Stockholm when they were going to, once upon a time, were there, and then I said that if this was more or less on the eve of the judgment, no?
Yes.
Then I said, well, if they choose me, they're making a mistake. Of course, I'll grab the prize if I can. But I think there are two candidates. Those two candidates would be Pablo Neruda and Jorge Eugen, at least in the Spanish language.
What about Gabriel Márquez?
Gabriel Márquez, I think he wrote the one book. I think the book, it falls off, no? I think it begins well, but then at the end, the writer is as tired as the reader, perhaps, no?
Mm-hmm. What about Cortázar?
I know very little about him. Mm-hmm. I was editing a literary magazine, then a young man came up to see me. He wrote a manuscript. Then he came back within 10 days. Then I told him the story was going to be published, but he was going to illustrate it. That story was La Casa Tomada by Julio Cortázar. Mm-hmm. Then I met him in Paris and he reminded me of the incident. But I haven't read his other books. That story is a very fine story. After the manner of perhaps Arthur Machen, or yes, I should say so.
Are there any of these writers, Mr. Borges, whose work simply resists Spanish translation into Spanish? Nabokov, for instance.
I wonder if he has been translated.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
But then he does resist, I guess.
Well, in the case of Joyce, of course, well, he can't be translated. I don't think James Joyce could be translated, unless he invented. No, but of course, in the case of James Joyce, I mean, he's crafted it out of the language. I mean, that kind of thing can't be translated. When he writes, for example, the rivering waters of, the hither and thithering waters of night. How can you translate that? How can you translate rivering waters of?
It's like translating Lewis Carroll.
Well, it can't be done.
No.
It hasn't been done in German, because German is more or less akin to English, but not in Spanish. In Spanish, the whole thing is rather lame, you know?
Mm-hmm. Is Shakespeare successfully translated into Spanish?
No. Because Shakespeare also, I mean, he abounds in verbal music, in word craft. That kind of thing can't be translated. I attempted a translation of Macbeth. And then after a scene or two, I felt I couldn't do it. And I left it. But Macbeth would be my favorite. The Shakespearean tragedy. I mean, it's so tense. It begins at full speed and then goes on until the end, no?
Yeah, right. Are you one of the last admirers of Kipling?
I hope I'm not one of the last. I think Kipling was a very great man.
I know you do. But he's not very widely appreciated read, is he?
No, because he's judged by his political opinions. And I suppose opinions are on the surface. I don't think a writer should be judged by his opinions. I think when you write, you should be judged, well, by what you write. And you don't write with your opinions. Opinions, after all, are on the surface. They come and go. People hold many different opinions. It is in their lifetime. But in the case of Kipling, he was a very wise man also. And his word craft is wonderful. When I remember, for example, Harp Song of the Dane Women, you see how stark the title of the poem is. How it doesn't even sound like English. It might be Old English or Old Norse. Harp Song of the Dane Women. And then Sick and Again for the Shouts and the Slaughter. There you get the Old English staff rhyme or alliteration. Sick and Again for the Shouts and the Slaughters.
Yes.
Look, he's a very fine writer.
Was he appreciated in your childhood in Spanish or not?
Yes, he was.
He was.
But people think of him, I think, if a writer writes for children, he makes a mistake. I mean, as concerns his own fame. Because people think of him as only writing for children. In the case of Stevenson, for example, why do people look down on Stevenson? Because they think only of Treasure Island. A very fine book, but the book meant for boys. But had they really saw the book, you feel that they're a very fine writer also. So perhaps it may be a mistake for a writer to attempt, let's say, it's a boyish fiction, or to attempt it's a detective fiction, because people think of him in terms of that particular kind of craft. I suppose in the case of Chesterton, people who know he's a very fine writer, but if people think of the Father Brown stories, then they're apt to class him with Ellery Queen or with even Philpotts or with any other writer.
Agatha Christie, yes.
Of course it was.
Is it a mistake?
It may be a mistake for the fame of a writer, not for the writer himself.
Sure.
Because after all, if the Father Brown stories didn't exist, I would feel it was a great loss. Mm-hmm. At least to me.
I agree.
But at the same time, it has done him no good. It has done no good to his reputation.
Well, would you go so far as to say that a writer who seeks fame ought not to read books that children can enjoyably read?
No.
What about Tolkien, for instance?
No. Well, Tolkien, I have found him. I only found him utter boredom. I have never got inside his books.
Who got inside his books?
I have never got inside his books. Mm-hmm. I have always been an outsider, no?
Yes.
I attempted the Brotherhood. You see, the Brotherhood of the Rings?
Yes. The Lordship of the Ring, isn't it?
The Lordship of the Ring. I don't know, but in any case, no rings were awarded me, no. I tried to enjoy him, I did my best. I was in Scotland at the time. There were two young Americans there who read him and laughed very loudly, but at the same time I felt that I got nothing out of the reading. When they compared him to Lewis Carroll, I thought that was sheer blasphemy, no. I'm so fond of Lewis Carroll. No, what I said was that a writer should not read, but not write. For children, because that may harm his reputation. Yeah. But after all, I wonder if reputations are worthwhile.
Well,
the problem is the work itself. The enjoyment of what you're doing. I always think of reading and of writing in terms of happiness. If you don't feel happy when you're reading or when you're writing, then, or if you don't feel greatly moved, then you're not really reading or writing. The whole thing is merely reading, I mean, for examination marks, and that, of course, I won't say that way madness lies, but that way dullness lies.
Are you really saying that all writers should enjoy, are you saying that writers should enjoy writing?
Well, of course they should. At least I do. I mean, I have to toil, I have to work, but at the same time I'm enjoying it. See, after all, I have chosen that literary fate for myself.
Well, do you think a gymnast should enjoy?
I know nothing whatever about gymnasts. So it's whatever I say.
Well, ought they to enjoy their exercises? Would you say? Are you making a universal statement that
all people
should enjoy their work?
No, I suppose sweeping statements should be avoided, and that's a sweeping statement also, no? Maybe one talks and falls into sweeping statements, no? In fact, if you talk, you are making a sweeping statement. If you say A is B, that's a sweeping statement, and it may not be always B. There's something else. But I enjoy writing. In fact, one of the few enjoyments left.
So, as you put it, you would write even if you were Robinson Crusoe, and there was no
well, Robinson Crusoe, the only thing I could do would be to write.
Yeah, you could build canoes.
Well, my canoes would be hardly worth the building. I don't think I'm any good at that kind of craft or any other.
You'd rather write a book about how to build a canoe than build a canoe, right?
Oh, yes, of course I would. Well, maybe I would choose another subject, no.
Well, in your judgment, is the new Philistinism about which there is a lot of talk these days?
I don't know. There are so many Philistines involved.
Which is the one to which you have a special allergy?
I hate nationalism.
As distinguished from patriotism?
Yes, I think nationalism is a mistake. And I think that we're all more or less nationalistic. Maybe I am. When you say Argentinian, I was very angry. There was no such word. The word should be Argentine. Argentina is an invention, I mean, a word that rhymes to Bolivian or Peruvian. There's no such word, of course, since Argentine is an adjective.
Argentine is an adjective?
Of course, the Argentine Republic. Because Argentine means silver because of the Rio de la Plata. Mm-hmm. Silver River, yes. Argentina is no such word.
Are you talking in English, you mean?
No, I don't think there's any such word. In Spanish, there's no such word. You never say Republica Argentina, it's the Republica Argentina. Mm-hmm. Nobody, if you said Argentina, people would stare at you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How common is that error?
Yes, I was asked all the time when I was in the state, people asked me, are you an Argentinian? I said, no, there's no such thing. Are you Spaniard? Well, I left off being a Spaniard 150 years ago. Are you Latin American? Well, no. Who knows what a Latin America is? There's no such thing. I mean, a man is a Colombian, a Peruvian, a Bolivian, an Uruguayan, but hardly a Latin American. There's no such thing.
Or an Argentine.
Or an Argentine. Why not? I do my best to be a good Argentine.
And you say you detect this nationalism even in yourself. Do you detect a lot of it in current literature?
I detect it in myself.
You do?
I don't know why, for example, I write so much about such a dull city of Buenos Aires, and yet I love it. I write so much about myself, I'm not an interesting character, and yet I keep on being interested in Jorge Luis Borges. I don't know why.
Well,
it's a lifelong habit.
One of the books about you says that your most intense experiences are autobiographical, but that doesn't mean either that you're narcissistic or that you're nationalistic, does it?
I don't think so. I suppose it means more essential things. It means, well, it might mean thinking or loving or falling in love or being crossed in love or being now and then happy in love. Those things are essential to a man.
But they're universals too.
They are universals, of course.
So therefore you're not committing the sin of nationalism?
No, no, I'm not.
Or of narcissism?
No, I'm not.
Writing.
No, I don't think I'm a narcissist or a nationalist for that matter. Nationalism, I think, is wrong in old countries, especially in a new country like the mine. I mean, you can imagine, for example, well, let's say you're a Chinaman or you're a Japanese, or European, or even for an American, you might be a nationalist. But here, where history is, let's say, some hundred and odd years old, I mean, there's a country with no local color like this. We only have, well, we had quite a fine history in the last century, and now I think that we're more or less improving. I mean, we went through a very sad period, but now things are better, or at least we should hope that they're better, because our hope is part of the bettering, no?
Yes. Well, it didn't undermine your appreciation of Kipling, his nationalism.
No, because I think the British Empire made for good. I think it was right there.
So maybe it did no good to England. Objective, not just nationalism.
But in the case of Kipling, I not only think the British Empire made for good, but I think that Kipling needed that faith in order to write his books, even as Walt Whitman needed democracy, or Neruda to communism, or Dante needed the Roman Catholic Church.
That it was a catalyst of his talent?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. But why not? That's allowable. Not only allowable, it was wished for.
Well, why don't we have any good literature coming out of the Soviet Union celebrating communism? Why isn't it a catalyst of anything beautiful?
Because people are bullied into it.
as distinct from Neruda, who was not?
No, he was not. Now, to the sincerity of Neruda, I know nothing whatever. But still, it made him, I mean, he was a bad sentimental poetry. His love poetry was quite bad. He thought so too. And then that political faith came to him and saved him. I only met Neruda once in my life. He thought that nothing would be done with the Spanish language. And then I said to him, something might be done with English. And then he said, well, something has been done. And then I said, Spanish, nothing has been done as yet. And I said, no, I suppose not. And I said, well, we'll have to do something for the godforsaken language. And, well, we did. Well, at least he did.
How many books ago was that conversation?
Eh? That must have been way back in 1920-odd, eh?
He was already a communist, was he?
I don't know, because he never spoke about politics. Mm-hmm. But he loved the English language. I suppose he always did.
Well, you say that if you're bullied, then you stifle the muse?
I think you do, eh?
Well, but
you stifle everything.
Dante was bullied.
I don't think he was bullied. No, I don't think he was bullied. I think he believed in it.
But he lived in an age in which it was dangerous not to believe, didn't he?
Well, suppose he was intensely religious. For example, I can't think of myself as being a Roman Catholic or even a Christian. Did I think I thoroughly enjoy the Divine Comedy without enjoying the framework, of course? Mm-hmm. I don't like the framework. The idea, I mean, of three institutions of hell, purgatory, and heaven, and paradise. I can't believe in that kind of thing. But still, if I accept that framework, then I have a wonderful poem, perhaps the greatest poem ever written. It's given me.
Mm-hmm. But why is it that there is no intense love of communism that has brought out an equivalent masterwork? Of course, I suppose you can't have an equivalent masterwork, but a masterwork. Why? How do you account for the aridity of the entire Soviet experience in the last 50 years, 60 years?
But you think aridity has to be explained away? I think it's quite common. For example, I'm hurting people by saying this. You take the United States, you have at least half a dozen men of genius. I mean, from
a
little point
of
view.
You mean in 200 years?
Well, you have, for example, you have Poe, you have Melville, you have Whitman, you have Hawthorne, you have Henry James. Well, you have Frost. What? Well,
Pound.
Well, I don't want to rope him in, but if you do, yeah. It's not my funeral. Well, but at the same time, if you think of Canada and Australia, they have produced practically nothing. So maybe the American Revolution made for good from a literary point of view.
In other words, you consider six people in 200 years a profusion of genius and aridity the rule of thumb.
Yes, I should say so.
But sure.
Well, what I mean to say is that, well, you may like or dislike Poe. I don't think much of him as a poet, but I think of him as being a man of genius. Mm-hmm. You may like or dislike Whitman. You can find quite bad lines in him. Mm-hmm. But he can't be thrown away. You can't think of contemporary literature and
dismiss Whitman.
Yes, and dismiss them. They can't be thrown away.
Right.
While other writers may be thrown away. For example, South America produced nobody worthwhile, I mean, to the whole world. I mean, I suppose we have some fine writers. They're fine writers, let's say, for Argentines, or for Chileans, or for Peruvians, and so on. But they mean nothing whatever to the world.
Well, you do. Neruda did.
Well, that's
Neruda did.
Well, in my case, I think that what you're saying is a form of pessimism, say that, or of optimism.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borges.
I have to thank you for extraordinary patience. No.
You can have my patience anytime you want.
Well, thank you, sir.
And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
RAE, Argentinian in the world.
RAE, Argentina al mundo.
Okay, folks, before signing off, let's go over the headlines again. Inflation in Argentina showed a slight increase in June, reaching 1.6%. A US judge rejected the Argentine government's request and upheld the ruling requiring the transfer of YPF shares. Brazil's President Lula da Silva signed the decree to impose reciprocal tariffs on the US. Uruguay's government agreed to modify its new passports after they were rejected by European countries. Another dead whale was found off the coast of Buenos Aires City. Sports: Argentina's top flight football league completed the first round of the Clausura tournament. And this way we come to the end of today's edition of RAE, Radio Difusión Argentina al Exterior, which was operated by sound technician Sergio Ríos and hosted by yours truly, Fernando Farias, a show that is aired via the shortwaves of WRMI, Miami Radio International, and also via internet on rae.com.ar. Thank you very much for listening, and hasta mañana.